together longer than we were apart. It's hard to see where you begin and where I start. Oh, like mine, but not much alike. When side by side, not always I do I. You make me feel brave, I can't explain.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. The Kingston Film Heritage Project and Vulnerable Media Lab have partnered to bring a Home Movie Day event to Kingston in October. Home Movie Day has been an annual celebration of home movies and immature films held at venues worldwide since 2003, started by a group of film archivists concerned about what would happen to all the home movies shot on film during the 20th century. The event gives community members an opportunity to see their films on the big screen, as well as have their memories digitized for free. Home Movie Day events also often include tips for preserving films. It was announced that Saturday, October 19th, will be the inaugural event for Kingston, taking place at the Screening Room. All proceeds for this event will also be going towards All Our Relations Land Trust, a charitable organization led by Indigenous peoples committed to supporting and protecting the environment in the Kingston area. The theme for films this year is transience. To learn more about this first-time event for the city, CFRC sat down with organizer Adam Cook. Here is a bit of that conversation. This year, the Kingston Film Heritage Project and Vulnerable Media Lab announced Home Movie Day 2024. So this has been kind of a named event since early 2000s. What is Home Movie Day?
Yeah, Home Movie Day started over 20 years ago. Basically, a group of film archivists were concerned about what was going to happen to all the home movies shot on film specifically during the 20th century, a kind of concern that we share at the Vulnerable Media Lab, which is housed in the Film and Media Department at Queen's. And it's an annual event held around the world with different participating cities where local home movies are exhibited for a public audience. This is the inaugural edition in Kingston, and we're really excited to be the ones hosting the first ever Home Movie Day in Kingston.
Yeah, awesome. What was sort of the inspiration to bring it to Kingston, and how are you and your team feeling about spearheading this inaugural year?
Yeah, well, it comes naturally to us working in the Vulnerable Media Lab, which is a state-of-the-art historic media transfer remediation and restoration research lab. Basically, we scan, digitize, and restore various media, including celluloid film, but not limited to it, mini DV tapes, VHS, et cetera, et cetera. So we're always looking to embark on new projects internally at the lab, but also curatorially. We like to, engage with the public, engage with Kingston, and specifically with the Kingston Film Heritage Project, which we've been running for some months now. We're looking to engage with the city's history, archival materials of the city, and now in the case of Home Movie Day, material produced by locals or people living here. It's okay if they're just passing through, too. Our theme for the first edition is transience.
Yeah, for sure. And could you get into that theme a little bit, transience? What was the choice there, and what does that mean exactly?
Well, what it means is something that we're happy to leave to the interpretation of those curious about submitting. Transients, of course, could really be used to describe home movies and vulnerable media in general, of course. The temporary nature of things, of material, but also the passage of time. Home movies are typically linked with nostalgia, so it seemed fitting to go with the theme of transients, but we wanted to keep it as open-ended as possible to let the folks who might have some home movies up in their attic or whatever that they want to dig out, some creativity when they're thinking of submitting to us.
Awesome. Yeah. And you describe this media as vulnerable. And of course, it's in the title there, Vulnerable Media Lab. I was wondering if you could get into a bit of what that means.
Yeah, well, of course, I'm sure people kind of envision celluloid film, 16 millimeter, 35 millimeter, Super 8, what have you, as being vulnerable. We know that it deteriorates over time unless it's kept in really ideal conditions. We do have our own vault, our own archive in the film and media department where we preserve a lot of different film. But actually, digital media is arguably just as vulnerable. It's a bit of a misnomer that it's celluloid film that is. So really, any kind of media, including contemporary forms of it, are all vulnerable to different forms of expiry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So I guess this event, yeah, it's about nostalgia, preservation. And yeah, are you hoping that this event will continue to be an annual thing in the future? Or are you guys just kind of rolling with it this year?
Well, ideally, yeah. I think it would be wonderful if this could be an annual event in Kingston and ongoing as part of the Kingston Film Heritage Project. What it actually turns out to be is really in the hands of the people listening to this right now. Submissions are open now, and we are open to anything, really. If people want information about how to submit their home movies, potentially have them digitized for their own posterity, and then potentially projected on the big screen, they can do so now. If they go to the Screening Room website, because that's where we will be hosting the screening, you'll find information there, or they can email me at 22AC18@queensu.ca for more information. So it's up to the people who submit their home movies what kind of content we'll get, and how much, what the volume of submissions will be. Hopefully it's popular. It's important to us to keep the barriers to a minimum for this event. So it is pay what you can, with proceeds going to a charity, all our relations land trust. And we'll be accepting submissions for the rest of the month, and then hosting the screening October 19th at 1 p.m. at the Screening Room.
Awesome. Yeah. And like you just said there, there's still quite a while to submit. Have you received any submissions so far? How's it looking?
Well, the submission process, we wanted to kind of make as easy as possible, both for those submitting and for ourselves. So submitting your home movie actually doesn't involve sharing your home movie with us. You just have to fill out a quick form. Honestly, it takes about 5 minutes to fill out. We just want to hear a little bit about what it is that you are thinking of submitting. And then based on that, we're going to contact a handful of people and get in touch with them about getting a hold of their home movies. And those are the ones that we'll digitize and project on October 19th.
Submissions for home movies to digitize and feature at the screening are being accepted until the end of September. You can visit screeningroomkingston.com for more details. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News on Kingston's very first home movie day. That wraps up your headlines for this evening, and next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
The This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is your sports report. The Gaels were in the nation's capital on Saturday looking for program win number 500. They took on the 2-1 Ottawa Gigis at Gigi's Field in a game noteworthy for its sweltering summer temperatures. Ottawa's first drive of the game was a good one, but stalled out in the Queen's red zone, leading to a field goal attempt by number 13th of Gigi's, Zachary Copeland. Copeland pushed it to the right, meaning that Queens had a chance to run this one back for a touchdown.
But it's going
to
be wide, and here we go. One of the most explosive playmakers in the OUA, Ian St. Arnaud, taking this one. He's making a couple men miss. He is still up on his feet. If he's going to get this done, he's got a lot of work to do. He's breaking down the right-hand side of the field. He's got one man to beat. He cuts it in. He cuts it back. Oh, my God! He did it again!
That's it for your Gaels! Three in a row!
I have never in my life seen someone like this. Lightning has struck a third time in 2 weeks.
The Gaels' offense would score on their first drive, making it 14-0 early in the first quarter, and then another special teams miscue from the Gigis, this time a blocked punt returned by Queens number 46, Jeremy Hiscox, gave the Gaels a 21-0 lead at the end of the first quarter. The Queens' offense would struggle a great deal in the second quarter with two consecutive Alex Vreeken interceptions, which gave Ottawa some much-needed momentum. The Gigis got the game within 11, trailing 31-20 at halftime. The Gaels' third quarter began poorly with another Alex Vreeken interception, but the Queens' defense would bail their offense out with this fantastic play by number 26, Keegan Vanek.
Miracle rolling out again. That time he gets hit. That is a pick.
Keegan Vanek, baby.
And you can put it on the board. That is 6 points for your Gaels. Number 26, Vanek victimizes Miracle again. And that one is going to hurt all the more as the Gaels put 6 more on the board.
He sees those Gigis, and he is just gunning for that interception.
Vanek's interception return for a touchdown gave the Gaels a 38-20 lead. They would add 10 more points over the next quarter and a half and shut out the Ottawa offense in the second half to walk away with a 48-20 victory. Vanek had a career day with 2 interceptions, including 1 return for a touchdown and a punt block. Meanwhile, on special teams, Ian St. Arnaud has had the most successful 7-day stretch of any special teams player in Canadian history, with 3 touchdowns and over 500 return yards in a 7-day period, starting on September 7th against York and being capped off with another virtuoso performance on September 14th against the Ottawa Gigis. The 3-1 Gaels will host the 3-1 Guelph Griffins this upcoming Saturday, September 21st at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Kickoff is scheduled for 3 p.m. and CFRC will be live with the Something in the Water pregame show at 2:45. On Saturday, September 21st, 2 perennial powerhouse programs in the OUA will go toe-to-toe at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Your Queens Gaels will host the Guelph Griffins. Last year, the Gaels and the Griffins waged war in a classic contest that went down to the wire. Can the Griffins get their revenge, or will the Gaels stay golden at Richardson Stadium? There's only one way to find out, and that's to tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Join us for our pregame show at 2:45 p.m. Kickoff is scheduled for 3. Trust me, folks, you don't want to miss this one.
This is Christina coming in with your CFRC weather report for this evening. Tonight, we're expecting clear skies with fog patches developing overnight, and we have a low of 13 degrees. Looking forward to tomorrow, Tuesday, September 17th, we're expecting sunny skies with fog patches dissipating in the morning. We have a high of 27 degrees with humidex that's going to feel like 34, and we have a UV index of 6 or high. Tuesday night, we'll have cloudy periods with a low of 16. On Wednesday, September 18th, we're expecting cloudy skies with a high of 23, and for the night, cloudy skies with a low of 16. On Thursday, September 19th, we have a mix of sun and cloud and a high of 25 degrees, and at night, clear skies with a low of 15. On Saturday, September 21st, we're expecting a mix of sun and cloud with a high of 22 degrees, and at night, cloudy periods with a low of 11. Finally, finishing off the week, on Sunday, September 22nd, we'll have a mix of sun and cloud and a high of 21. That wraps up your CFRC weather report for this evening, and next up is your CFRC weekly traffic report.
This is your CFRC weekly traffic report. I'm Michael Bulos. Pavement rehabilitations will take place along Highway 401 between Westbrook Road to beyond the Highway 15 overpass and on Sir John A. McDonald overpass. This work will consist of various lane and ramp closures over the next several months. Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard ramp closures will be from September 18th overnight from 8 p.m. to 6 p.m. Highway 401 westbound at Highway 15 will have a full mainline closure over the following days, September 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise users that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to motorists, cyclists, and pedestrians until further notice. Road closures. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert Street, closed until December 31st to accommodate construction, activity, and staging at 484 Albert Street. Bagot Street, Barrie to West, closed September 15th from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. for the Battle of Britain Parade. Barrie Street, Stewart to Bagot, closed September 15th from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. for the Battle of Britain Parade. Churchill Crescent, College North to College South, closed September 14th from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. for the annual Neighborhood Street Festival. Concession Street, Lansdowne to Alfred, closed September 15th from 6:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. for a gas service installation. Cooper Street, Albert to Collingwood, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Davidson Street, Pembroke to Ellerbeck, closed September 14th from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. for the Livingston Ave block party. Edwin Street, Collins Bay to Waverly, closed until September 18th for the removal and reinstatement of asphalt. Hillcrest Ave, Kings Court to 7th, closed until October 31st for buried infrastructure replacement. Road will be open to local traffic. Joyceville Road at CN Rail Tracks, closed September 15th at 5 p.m. to September 18th at 6 p.m. for crossing repairs. Detours will be in place for the duration of this closure. Kings Court Avenue, Hillcrest to Kirkpatrick, closed until November 15th to accommodate a water main replacement. King Street, Place d'Armes to north end of King, closed until September 30th for the construction of new storm and roadbed. Road will be open to local traffic. Livingston Avenue, King to Union, closed September 14th from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. for the Livingston Ave block party. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen, closed until September 27th for downtown Kingston BIA activations. Union Street, Victoria to Albert, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. University Avenue, Union to Earl, closed for construction-related activity at Queen's John Deutsch University Center project. Parking disruption. The Hanson Memorial Parking Structure Restoration Project is now underway. The work will take place throughout all levels of the building and will include efforts such as routine structural maintenance, repainting, replacement of waterproofing materials, and upgrades to the building's mechanical and electrical systems. The work is planned to begin the first week of February 2024 and conclude in late December 2024. The work will be completed in phases to allow the building to remain open to public for the duration of the project. It is anticipated that no more than 50% of the available 271 parking spaces will be closed at any time. There is also parking availability at the Chown Memorial and Robert Bruce Memorial parking garages in the two adjacent blocks to the west. Other delays. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl. Expect delays and closures along Aberdeen Street for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Bayridge Drive, Princess to Taylor Kidd. Expect delays while a contractor begins phase two of the Bay Ridge Drive active transportation upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles Edwin to Princess. Expect delays while a contractor completes phase two of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Gardner's Road at Centennial Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbey Dawn to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbey Dawn Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Ontario Street, Brock to Clarence. Expect a southbound lane closure September 17th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. to facilitate the installation of vinyl wraps on the planters at City Hall. Detours will be in place for the duration of the closure.
Thanks so much. Here's your CFRC concert calendar for today. On Monday, September 16th, check out the Monday Afternoon Jazz Jam led by Oscar Evans at the RCHA. The show starts at 4:30 p.m. and is $5. Also on Monday night, you can check out Authority Zero, Belvedere, Melon Ball, and the Meringues at the Broom Factory for $25 in support of the Meringues' latest album release starting at 7:30 p.m. On Tuesday, September 17th, Tom's Tuesday Afternoon Happy Hour Jam with host Tom Savage is back. Drop by the RCHA from 4 to 7 p.m. for a free show. Also on Tuesday, Law and Yarrow are playing a by-donation show at the Next Church starting at 7 p.m. On Wednesday, September 18th, Canadian singer-songwriter legend Martha Wainwright takes the stage at the Broom Factory starting at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $40. Also on Wednesday, you can check out Hemingford, Quebec folk duo The Co-Conspirators for free at Hotel Wolf Island, starting at 6 p.m. Later that evening, Too Many Zoos will play a show at the Mansion starting at 8:30 p.m., and tickets are $30. On Thursday, September 19th, you can see Michael George for $5 at the RCHA starting at 7 p.m. Open Season Thursdays with Chris Brown, Joey Wright, and Jason Mercer starts at 7 p.m., Thursdays at Hotel Wolf Island. You can also check out Rev Zed, Mason FM, and the Clay Pigeons for only $5 at the Mansion on September 12th from 8:30 to 11:30 p.m. On Friday, September 20th, you can see Cazador with Sparrow Blue, The High Loves, and Julia Finnegan at the Broom Factory starting at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $23. You can also join the Happy Hour TJIF at the RCHA featuring a performance by the Smokin' Roosters, a free event starting at 4 p.m. Then stick around for Whiskey Smoke, a country duo featuring Amanda Sorensen and Mike Grice at the RCHA for $5 starting at 8 p.m. Also on Friday, you can enjoy some chill folk rock by Chris Gagier and the Larks for free at Musiki Cafe starting at 8 p.m. Ottawa folk artist Graven with Stephen Stanley will play a show at Hotel Wolf Island on Friday, starting at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $25. And Friday night, starting at 8, folks can dance it up for free at Springer Market Square with music by DJ Trueways. On Saturday, September 21st, folks can drive out to Westport for West Porch 2024 to enjoy live free country, bluegrass, jazz, blues, folk, rock, and more music from front porches in downtown Westport, a free event running all day. Also on Saturday, you can go see Mo Kenny, Piner, and Marlo Green at the Broom Factory. The show starts at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are $20. Dead Root Revival will also play at RCHA on Saturday night starting at 8 p.m. Tickets are $20. CFRC's own John McClurg will play a show at the Cove Inn in Westport by donation starting at 5 p.m. You can also catch China Cat Riders with the Cherry Garcia Band for free at Hotel Wolf Island on Saturday night starting at 8:30 p.m. On Sunday, September 22nd, you can enjoy a show by Jake Fadlin and the Sturgeon River Boys at the Broom Factory starting at 2 p.m. Also on Sunday, check out the Brick House Polka Band and Celtic Kitchen Party at Daff Brewing starting at 1 p.m. Tickets are $25. You can also enjoy some dinnertime jazz by donation at Hotel Wolf Island starting at 4 p.m. And also on Sunday, Christina Foster and Anna Sudak are playing a show in support of the Little Cat Rockaway Creek Conservation Area's 60th anniversary. The show at Little Cat starts at 1 p.m. and is $5. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca. Here's your CFRC events calendar for today. On September 16th through the end of the month, you can join the Kingston Writers Fest Reading Challenge by reading books on the KWF reading list and be entered into contests to get tickets to see authors in person at the upcoming festival. Learn more on the KWF website. Also on Monday, September 16th, you can head over to the Art and Media Lab at the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts for an exhibit by award-winning artist Evan Sharma called My Experiments in Hope, a free event. Also at 6 p.m. on the 16th, you can enjoy free summer swing dancing at the Newlands Pavilion Gazebo by Murney Tower. The Brass and One-Eyed Jacks will host their weekly trivia games starting at 7 and 7:45 p.m. respectively. On Tuesday, September 17th, the Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Tuesday, you can also grab your runners and head over to Lululemon downtown at 5:30 p.m. for a weekly fun run. Jog, mingle, and have fun. This run is for all ages and abilities. You can also head over on Tuesday evening to Spearhead Brewing for board games night starting at 4 p.m. On Wednesday, September 18th, head over to the Rideau Heights Community Center for the Fresh Food Market pop-up featuring fresh, healthy, and affordable food options between 2 and 5 p.m. Also on Wednesday, there will be a public talk called Empowering Neurodivergence, Harnessing Strengths for Success. Watch party will be held at Duncan MacArthur Hall from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Something in the Water Brewing and Daft Brewing will host their trivia nights starting at 7 p.m. and One-Eyed Jacks will host North End Board Games Night for free, also starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, September 19th, Kingston Community Health Centers will host a senior social group for folks ages 55 and over from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Also on Thursday, Nobel laureate Dr. David E. Card will present a talk called Cause and Effect and Evidence-Based Policies, a W.A. McIntosh public lecture taking place in Stirling Hall at Queen's University from 4 to 5:30 p.m. Also on Thursday, head over with your runners to Runner's Choice for the weekly Out in Front running group for 2SLGBTQ+ runners ready to run at 6:15 p.m. for 5 to 6 kilometers, followed by a post-run social. You can also check out the musical All I Really Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten at the Spire from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m., a show running nightly through the 21st. On Friday, September 20th, the YMCA will host its Fresh Food Pop-Up Market, featuring healthy food options that won't break the bank. Also on Friday from 6 to 9 p.m., you can attend a Pet Bowls pottery making workshop and learn to make a custom pet bowl at Amaranth Stoneware out on 745 Development Drive. Registration is $70. On Saturday, September 21st, the Kingston Public Market runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Also on Saturday, the Friends of Lemoyne Point Fall Tree, Shrub, and Wildflower Sale will take place from 9 till noon at the Lemoyne Point Conservation Area. Princess Street Promenade also returns on Saturday from 10 to 5, running down Princess Street from Barrie to Ontario. Folks can also check out the Foraging for the Seasons workshop running at the Calvin Park branch of the Kingston Frontenac Public Library from 1 to 3 p.m. and learn about foraging wild edible foods. You can also enjoy a free observatory tour and astrophysics talk called From Dust Grains to Stars and Shots in the Dark by Queen's PhD candidate Parissa Nozari, a public event at the Queen's Observatory taking place from 7:30 to 10 p.m. You can also have a chance to look through the telescope into the night sky, weather permitting. On Sunday, September 22nd, get up early and head over to Runner's Choice for an early morning long run starting at 8:30 p.m. Also on Sunday, the Kingston Intercultural Arts Festival runs from 11:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Confederation Park. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 2 p.m. featuring food, artisanal crafts, and music. Have a concert or event you would like to add to our online or on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca. Don't forget to follow CFRC on Instagram at cfrcmusic.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. For 50 years, the Banri Foundation has supported the continuing education of women at Queen's. Join Banri for its 50th anniversary gala on October 24th at 7 p.m. at the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. This event marks half a century of empowering women through education. Tickets are free, but registration is required. To reserve your spot, visit the Banri Center's website, follow Banri Center on Facebook and Instagram, or email brc@queensu.ca.
Good day. You're tuned into Free City Radio. This is edition 232. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. On this broadcast, I'm going to be featuring a conversation I had with John Tarleton. John is the editor of The Independent, a critically important grassroots media project in New York City. You can find it around Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, and beyond in boxes. It is a project that is real in person and also is online. That's independent with Y. I spoke with John about the project and also, importantly, about his work to tell the stories of the Palestine Solidarity Movement in New York City, which is very important. So I just wanted to leave it there, and I will share my conversation with John Tarleton of The Independent in New York City.
So, John, you've worked so hard for a number of years on this project, The Independent in New York City. I've noticed that in the recent months, you've really made a significant effort to document and speak to the major demonstrations happening in support of Palestinian human rights. Could you introduce the project, The Independent, and speak a bit about your coverage around these ongoing protests in New York City in support of Palestinian human rights?
Right. So The Independent is a New York City-based a radical newspaper that's in its 24th year of publishing. It started in sort of the post-Battle of Seattle global justice movement days, and it was originally inspired by the kind of issues of challenging corporate power that were on people's minds in that era. But as you know, as time and events have unfolded, we've covered many other movements and movement moments, as well as many countless grassroots organizations here in New York who are just fighting daily struggles around tenants' rights, police brutality, environmental justice, and on down the line. And one issue that we've covered repeatedly over the past two decades is Israel-Palestine. It's a recurring issue, a recurring struggle for the Palestinians to try to claim some rights and self-determination for themselves. And of course, it's a big deal here in New York. There's a large Jewish diasporic population in New York that's had a lot of success, has overcome a lot of adversity, and is very politically, socially powerful. And it's also divided between people that take sort of a traditional, staunch pro-Israeli stance, and many, many members of the Jewish community who have become increasingly critical of the Israeli regime and the whole Zionist ideology that it's based on. And there's also a large Arab populations here in New York City that are concerned about Palestine. And I think also more broadly, even if you're not Jewish or Palestinian, the stark injustice and the incredibly racist nature of these injustices that are perpetrated against the Palestinians, I think is something that provokes a response from any person of conscience, certainly with strong progressive anti-racist beliefs. So it's a big deal here in New York, as it is elsewhere, and we've tried to cover it over the last 20 years repeatedly. So when the events of October 7th happened and we knew the aftermath was going to be intense, we sort of drew on our experience of covering this issue in the past and really returning to it with a lot of energy and commitment. And we've come out with two special editions since then, as well as countless articles on our website, numerous segments on our weekly radio show on WBAI, a listener-sponsored station here in New York, and as well as breaking news coverage from various protests here in New York, Washington, etc. And in our first special edition that came out at the beginning of November, we decided to just try to help people get up to speed on what was happening. And our cover article was called History Lesson, Our Easy-to-Follow Guide for Understanding the Israel-Palestine Conflict. Because what we found is that there's a lot of people that who are tuning into what's happening now, and they sense that something is wrong, that there's a lot that they don't understand about this conflict, but they really haven't had time to pay attention and have felt kind of overwhelmed by trying to make sense of all the competing claims and the all the zigs and zags of the history around this. So we created a three-page package where we just have these little historical vignettes that walk you through the history going back to the Balfour Declaration in 1917 and even the Ottoman rule of Palestine that preceded it, and move you through different key events in the development of the Zionist project, and as well as the Palestinian response. And I think the key point we try to get across is that yes, the Jewish people suffered enormously throughout their history, and that was part of the inspiration for Zionism as conceived in the late 19th century. And then, of course, the Holocaust gave a further impetus that led to the formation of the State of Israel. But nonetheless, an enormous crime was committed against the Palestinian people with the founding of Israel and and the ethnic cleansing that accompanied it. The 750,000 people who were displaced, thousands who were massacred, 500 villages and towns that were depopulated. And along with this enormous crime came a huge lie, which was that Palestine had been a land without a people for a people without a land, as classic settler colonial ideology there. I mean, we had a version of that here in the United States with Manifest Destiny. Oh, well, nobody was really here before, so we just kind of took it and made it better. And so while we want to be sympathetic to the experience of the Jewish people, it's crucial for any realistic understanding of what's going on is that the Palestinians were the victim of an enormous crime that has been not only was perpetrated in 1948, but continues to be perpetuated till this very day. I mean, we see the Israeli government clearly, their strategy seems to have been to so devastate Gaza and immiserate its people that they would be forced to flee into the Sinai Desert and never come back to Gaza. Now, that may not happen. The Egyptian government may not go along with it. But the same logic of expansion, land grabs, military violence, apartheid has been there from the beginning. And it's crucial to understand that. And that explains a lot of what's going on today. And it also explains the incredible domestic repression that critics of Israel are facing here in the United States and elsewhere. Why? Because once you scratch beneath the surface, what the Israelis are doing cannot be justified. It's so certainly not this version of an Israeli apartheid state. You can't morally justify what they're doing. And so there's nothing else that Israel supporters can do but try to smear and defame people and force them into silence. They can't justify, their fascist Disneyland in Israel. They can only try to smear and deflect and defame people. So, but one of the heartening things we've seen and covered is that while some people have sort of retreated into a sort of a shell of a sort of unquestioning support for Israel, many other people, including large numbers of younger activists and others in the Jewish community, are challenging all of this like never before. So we've tried to, be a source of education, information for people. Also, covering the protests and all that are going on, giving people a sense of sort of the dynamism of this movement. And then in our December edition, our cover story, we kind of pivoted from the big picture of history and why this is happening, to a cover story that featured the Little Palestine community, which is based in southern Brooklyn. And more than for many Palestinians who will never be able to go, or will not for any time in the immediate future be able to go back to Palestine, this is as close as they can come to being in their own homeland in terms of the food, the culture, the language, all of that. And we have this wonderful writer. Her name's Laura Noor Walton, Egyptian American woman. She's spent time going around the community, talking to people, and was able to paint a really lovely picture of this community that's in a lot of distress because of the war, but is also incredibly resilient and a real center of Palestinian culture in New York City. And so it was a way to try to humanize the Palestinians, because I think right now sometimes there's a binary, Israel supporters, portray the Palestinians as sort of this, terrorists, terrible people, demonic, all of that. And sometimes their supporters on the left can tend to see them as sort of these helpless, bombarded victims. Actually they're full spectrum human beings. And when they have half a chance to live a normal life, what you see is something like Little Palestine, a very beautiful, vibrant community made up of people with varying perspectives on the world they live in and how they want to pursue their lives.
Well, one thing I really love about this process that you described of speaking to what's happening in a very local way is, I think this is one of the challenges of a lot of, progressive publications around the world right now, which is that tension between the local and the global. And one thing I've felt very strongly with The Independent over many years is you really have a root in New York City, obviously. Your paper is distributed in physical format in the city, and you speak to very local struggles while also speaking about international affairs. And I think that's really special and rare. Could you talk about the community aspect of what you do, both on this particular struggle, Palestine, but also more broadly, and why that process of community media actually having roots in community experience, day-to-day realities, is important?
Right. Well, we all live somewhere, and that somewhere has particular people in particular communities and needs and interests and histories. And I think part of being politically relevant is being aware of the actual community and communities that you live in. While it's obviously very important to have a understanding of the sort of bigger picture and a sense of international solidarity and those things, it's also important to be connected to where you are Also, for most people who are do not think of themselves as activists and in that sort of way, they are certainly, you know, mostly thinking about their lives in terms of where they are and how they're going to survive and thrive, dealing with paying the rent at the end of the month, wondering if their children's schools are going to fall apart or get better, wondering about their health care, wanting real public safety and not police brutality. All those things happen where people live. So we try to be there as well, and both communicating a sense of those immediate struggles in the organizations and movements that are engaged with them, but of course connecting them to a larger vision of the world. But I think to be credible when you talk about your sort of the larger picture of things, I think you have more credibility if people already feel like you understand their lives as they live their lives, where they are and where you are. If you're just gonna huff and puff and talk, you know, a lot of big picture stuff with no sense of connection to people's lived experiences, where they are, I think you're gonna lose a lot of people. Yes, the sort of the activist choir, might appreciate that up to a point, but you're losing out on the chance to connect and communicate with a lot more people. And that's sort of always been our goal since the beginning. And I think it's why we've had a staying power over the last 24 years. And I think in our second December issue, we had these sort of back-to-back articles, and we had like a 10-page section dealing with various aspects of the war and its ramifications all the way from Palestine to here in New York. We had one article by Rebecca Chowdhury that looked at all these different people of color-led community organizations in New York and how they were engaging with the war and expressing solidarity with the Palestinian people, young education advocates, housing rights groups that were connecting their struggles against displacement in Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx to the even more dire displacement that takes place every day in Palestine. We heard from various other groups as well that were connecting their struggles to those of the Palestinians. And then we also had an article from a writer we were in touch with in Denmark who was covering protests that were taking place, blockades outside of the offices of major weapons manufacturers in Denmark who were helping ship weapons to Israel. And these blockades and actions are taking place all over the place. So in sort of back-to-back articles, you have the perspective of the really grassroots here in New York, and then these grassroots movements in Denmark and many other places that are trying to immediately put themselves in the way of these arms exports. They're going straight to Israel and then being used against the Palestinians. So, you know, I think there's a space for both of that in a publication like ours. And I think people appreciate that, again, that sense of connection to where they are and a vision, a bigger vision of the world, a world of communities like their own, like that are struggling for justice. So, yeah, it's good. We just try to make those connections back and forth and do it in a way that feels real. It's not a lot of hot air and rhetoric, but it is based on solid reporting and a incisive analysis that people, you know, can follow and understand.
If people visit New York City, they'll see the boxes for The Independent all over, including the issues you talked about, these issues focused on Palestine, but also past issues focused on tenant rights, on movements against police violence. Can you just share with people who are listening from other places, just physically? I think it's really rare that this sort of activist, community-oriented, progressive publication has New York City newspaper boxes. You have them all over the place with your journal. So how many copies go out? And I would imagine there's a huge amount of labor of people that go and drop off these newsprints and check to make sure the boxes are okay. But this is such an important lifeline to a different opinion than, say, for example, the New York Times. I'm thinking about how the New York Times has failed in really this specific moment in having enough capacity to tell the human story of the Palestinians.
Yeah, we're printing about 30,000 papers a month, and we do have our red and white news boxes on street corners across the city. We also have the paper in about 60 public libraries in the various boroughs. And then we're also in, you know, independent bookstores, coffee shops, movement centers, other venues. We have a presence on the ground. You know, if we had more resources, I think we would love to have an even bigger presence. I mean, I think these two issues, if we had the capacity, we probably could have distributed hundreds of thousands of copies. But we work with the resources we have, and that's what we're able to do. I think it's refreshing for people. And I think people in this time appreciate the analog nature of the newspaper. You know, everybody's on their screens all the time. Now you have a newspaper you can take home, flip through, read it at your leisure, share with your housemates or your friends or your family members. And, of course, we're online. We have plenty of coverage on our website, independent.org, on Indie Twitter, Indie Instagram, our weekly radio show. So it's not like it's, you know, newspaper or bust, but I do think the newspaper adds a unique dimension to what we're doing. And I think a lot of people still want that. And of course, there's a visibility, just having those boxes on the corners, having the papers right there at the entrance to various libraries in neighborhoods all over the city. So we're doing the best we can to be a presence in as many ways as we can.
Just last question, the contrast between New York Times and the Independent, I think, is particularly resonant at this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Times has they've done a very poor job of covering the war. They're still doing coverage of what happened on October 7th, which was obviously, there were shocking atrocities that took place that day. But, we're at a point now where something like 20 times as many Palestinians have been killed in the onslaught that followed October 7th. The displacement of almost 2 million people, the complete destruction of all the infrastructure there, it dwarfs what was perpetrated against the Israelis. But you would hardly get any sense of that from reading the New York Times. And also, the Times really joined in a really shameful way in propagating this smear campaign that college campuses are overrun by anti-Semitism. Well, most of the problem on college campuses right now is a shocking repression of pro-Palestinian speech. You know, that's led to the firings and of university presidents and many other people, and students having to fear that their job prospects will be ruined for simply showing up at a protest and holding a sign. So the Times has given tremendous oxygen to all of that. We have some very wealthy donors at places like Harvard and Columbia and the University of Pennsylvania who've they think they're defending Israel, and they're joining forces with these very reactionary culture warriors that just want to undermine the credibility of universities in general, and the whole idea of higher education, as being some sort of woke experience that ruins the lives of young people. Anyway. It's a disgraceful situation, and the Times lent enormous credibility to this. We had a sort of a McCarthyite congressional hearing, I think, in late November, early December, where the Republicans completely demagogued the situation, and you had several Ivy League university presidents who were caught completely flat-footed, gave very awkward lawyerly responses, and in an attempt to defend the idea of free speech, even if you don't like what you hear. But the New York Times, and also to right-wing reactionaries and Israel supporters, you know, just steamrolled these people. And you know, there's an enormous struggle underway throughout our cultural institutions right now, where supporters of Israel, allied with other right-wing forces in this society, are trying to essentially expel the left from his, not only the left, but even the most milquetoast liberals from as many cultural institutions as they can, be it universities, cultural spaces, et cetera. And so that's kind of like the war at home. I mean, there's obviously the very real war on the ground in Gaza and other parts of the Middle East region. And then there's this sort of second front here at home, where supporters of Israel, again, because they can't really defend what Israel does, are just trying to suppress as much speech as possible. And there's other right-wing elements that basically, they're like, your enemies are our enemies, so let's join forces and try to take down as many of these people as possible. So that's a whole other fight we have here at home and here in the U.S., and I suspect it's a similar situation in Canada and other Western nations, where there's both strong opposition to what Israel is doing, as well as entrenched political establishments that are 100% committed to Israel and to Western, you know, imperialism in the Middle East and throughout the world.
John, thanks so much for taking the time to chat today.
You bet. It's always a pleasure to be on the show with you, Stefan.
That was a conversation with John Tarleton, the editor of the independent, critically important grassroots media project in New York City. Thanks, John, for being on the show. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CJLO 1690 a.m., also in Geogeague, Montreal, on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays, and on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. We are also a podcast. Look us up on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search Free City Radio. Our archives are at soundcloud.com/Free City Radio. Thank you to the Social Justice Center at Concordia University in Montreal for supporting this program. I'm Stefan Christoph, and I will speak to you next week.